So from my perspective, if we can have collaboration be an integral part of how we work, how we earn our daily bread, well, that experience will change us. We will bring that spirit of collaboration to our families, to our neighborhoods, to our institutions, to our politics. And that's the shift that I see that is possible. That's so exciting.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Peter Lafter. Peter's an expert in crafting stories and coaching people to find purpose in their life and in their work. Peter talks about how growing up with dyslexia and ADHD drew him to storytelling as a way to cope with the world around him. He also shares practical tips on building your storytelling muscle to connect emotionally with people in a way they'll never forget. Then we talk about purpose. You know, that thing you're supposed to have that gives your life meaning. Peter believes you already have one. Everyone does. It's simply a matter of revealing it. And once you know it, all the big decisions in your life that you're struggling with, around your career and your relationships, become much simpler. Finally, we explore the crisis leaders face today with the lack of engagement most people feel at work. If leaders really care about tapping into the creativity of their teams, they need to abandon traditional hierarchies and push decision-making out to the farthest reaches of the organization. Man, this was so much fun. Please enjoy Peter Lafter. All right, welcome Peter to the podcast. Super looking forward to this. So it's so interesting. I often spend some time trying to think about how to kick a podcast off. And in your case, or what I sometimes do, obviously, a fairly innocuous question is I ask somebody, how do you pronounce your last name? And, you know, for a lot of people, it's a question asked and answered 1,000 times in their life. And as I was doing a bit of research, I came across a podcast. And it turns out that's really not a simple, well, it's a simple answer, but there's a really interesting story around that. So I'd love to start there.
Yeah, my name has had a really interesting, you know, history. The name I was born with was Peter Fracasso, which is my father's name. And he left when I was 2, and I saw him once between the ages of 6 and 8 and never again after that. And really did not have a big hand in my life. And that would have been fine, except Fracasso in Italian means explosion or natural disaster, which for folks who know me, it kind of tracks. Yeah, that would work. But in certain Latin American countries, it translates directly to fuck up. Yeah. And one of those countries is Mexico, where I lived. I would get this regular occurrence of being at a bank or making collect call and having people just laugh hysterically when I told my name, and with good reason. I totally understood it, but it really was very jarring. Like, why am I carrying on this name of this man who didn't really raise me and didn't support me? Or, you know, and shouldn't I honor my mother's name, which was, you know, the woman who raised me and had the biggest influence on my life and who was always there for me? And her name was definitely an upgrade from fuck up, but not a big one. It was Slaughter. Slaughter's better than fuck up, you know? So when I got home from Mexico, I told her I was going to change my name and take on her name. And she's like, well, it's really interesting you mentioned that. I was thinking of dropping the S from my name. And we did that together. I took on her name and together we dropped the S and spelled L-A-U-G-H-T-E-R, at which my mother decided to pronounce Lauder. And I thought that was a good idea because I, at the time, thought I was going to get my doctorate. And I thought Dr. Lafter sounded way too much like a drug dealer or a pimp. And so let's, so I went with Lauder. And for years, I was Peter Lauder. And then I got married. She thought I was insane for pronouncing it that way. And so she went by Stacy Lafter. And I went by Peter Lauder. And that's just the way it went for a number of years. And my daughter was born. And when she got to be about 4 years old and could make these decisions on her own, she agreed with her mom, that I was crazy for pronouncing it Lauder. And she also went by Lafter. And not long after that, much to my surprise, I found myself introducing myself as Peter Lafter. And it really allowed me to understand the power of names, because when you introduce yourself as Peter Laughter, you get a very specific and wonderful response. People say things like, oh, you must be so funny, or oh, you must be so happy. And when you hear that, you actually start to believe it.
You know, that's so interesting for lots of different reasons, Peter. You know, when you introduce yourself as Peter Laughter, I'm always interested in things that we learn at the extreme. So, you know, you can think about that reaction that you get, but what if, you know, what if your name was Slaughter and you'd get maybe a very different reaction, but people wouldn't necessarily share it because it's laughter and it's positive. People love it. But if it wasn't so positive, there'd be all this subconscious stuff happening that is invisible to maybe both of you, but certainly to you. And so, yeah, the power of people's names I love that.
And my mother was a hard woman, so carrying the name Slaughter around for, I'm sure, had something to do with that.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you, Peter, about is you describe yourself as a storyteller. And I think people listening are probably already getting the sense that you're, you know, living up to that claim. But I do admit that I hear a lot of people saying that, you know, the power of story, and people describing themselves as storytellers seems to be increasingly common. At least I don't remember that being, at least I didn't notice it a few years ago. And so I'm wondering what that means to you. Like, how did that part of your persona become important to you?
So I'm dyslexic. Yeah. And I have ADHD, which is a great combination as a young child in the 70s going to school where they have no capacity to deal with that. And so a lot of things I really struggled with academically as a child. But I remember my first grade teacher, Mrs. Upton, reading this book, My Father's Dragon. It was a series of books. And she commented that I would just be completely captivated. And it was like the world would go away. And that was always the reaction I had to consuming stories as a child. And then I had the opportunity to meet some really amazing storytellers. This guy, Al Filaris, who is now head of University of Pennsylvania, Kelly's Writer's House. But he was my camp director, and he was just this amazing storyteller. And I mean, he told me stories when I was 9 years old that I still remember and can pretty much repeat. I just love the idea of this man who was able to create almost a time machine into his own life. And it just pulled me away. And then in college, I met a friend's uncle who was a storyteller, and it just seemed like magic to me. And then I, just by chance, I had a friend who is a writer, and she had won a Moth Story Slam in Chicago, and she was visiting in New York and said, hey, I have tickets to a Moth Slam here in New York. Would you like to come? And I was always intrigued. I had heard the radio show, and I went, and I realized, oh, I could tell a story that fits this theme. And I put my name in the hat, and I was convinced, oh, I'll never get called. And sure enough, I did. And I told the story, and it wasn't particularly good. But no one tried to eat me or throw rotten vegetables at me. And I thought, well, it was just so much fun. And so I started doing it more often. And since then, I've had a realization. So my purpose in life, based on the fact that humans are deeply and profoundly connected in ways that we are aware of and ways that we cannot possibly see. But my purpose is to lift up those connections so they're visible and tangible in our day-to-day lives. And I realize that storytelling is such a perfect venue for that. If I am in and listening to a live story and the storyteller says something and I have this realization, which often happens, like, oh my goodness, the stranger on stage and I are the same. There is this deep and profound experience that we've shared that is central to our lives, and we share it. There's this deep connection. We don't even know each other. And then as the story progresses, I might notice someone sitting, you know, near me who is visibly having that same experience. And there, the three of us are sharing this profound connection that generally spreads to a huge portion of the audience. And it is one of those rare moments where we actually feel that connection and feel it with strangers, right? It's rare enough to happen with people who we're close with, but when it happens with a stranger, that's real magic. And for me, storytelling is the art of connecting and for creating empathy and nothing else. And how it is viewed is storytelling as a tool to sell, to convince. And I think they're missing the point, frankly. Now, all of those things are things that can happen very effectively once you've made a connection, but using storytelling to accomplish those things feels to me as manipulation, as opposed to opening up a profound connection with someone or an audience, and then being able to communicate something interesting inside of that connection. That is where the power is.
God, I love so much of that. You talked about it being a time machine, and you also said it's like magic, and that's exactly how I would describe it. And I'd love to be better at it. And you're right. I think, you know, I appreciate you sharing that perspective on what storytelling means to you, because it's a term that's kind of thrown around pretty lightly. And I think it is like, what is the story of our company? How are we going to attract the right employees? How are we going to attract the right customers? How do we use story to do that? Which it does seem like a bit of a sleazy application of the true art as you've described it.
Yeah, and I hesitate to use the word sleazy, and because I don't think connection is part of our zeitgeist. I think it's becoming important, yeah. But I think for the most part, people really focused on the result and not the path. And I think for me, I know that the path is what produces the result. You know, for a while, I stepped into the space. I was an entrepreneur in the recruiting and staffing industry, which is just recruiting is horribly, horribly broken because it applies the simple process of buying stuff to the immensely complex process of engaging with other human beings. So I left that industry, and right out of the gate, I started a consulting coaching firm helping senior executives who dread going to work in the morning and wanted more for the last stretch of their career. And I thought it would be a repeatable business. For me, it wasn't. I thought it'd be 70% education, 20 to 30% coaching, and it was 80% coaching and maybe 20% education. So it just wasn't scalable in the way I thought it was. But I realized I hated selling myself as the product. Like, it was so hard for me. Like, if I am selling a service or a product, I can connect with you and explore if you need that service or product, and I can separate that decision for myself. But suddenly, when I was the product and you don't need it or want it, I hate you. You know, so like it turned that, you know, and it was very, very hard for me just to be comfortable in making the connections and explore that, because I just couldn't separate my ego from it. Although I love coaching, it's a wonderful experience, and I have a few clients who I still continue to coach, and I love it. But I just can't sell myself as a coach. It's just too hard for that reason, because I can't tell that story.
I must admit, a term that I just came across in reading up on you before this, and you mentioned non-hierarchical organizations. Can you talk a little bit about what that is? Because you spend much of your time doing that now, I think, right?
Yeah, it is a huge component of how I spend my time right now. So I was a Quaker school, the one where I went to high school, and there was this effort to separate from the body of Quakers that owned the school in paper only for a number of different reasons. And it was an incredibly contentious issue. And people were behaving really badly in our quarterly meetings, yelling, calling names. And I joined the effort. I realized, oh, wait, some of these people who are behaving badly and throwing these emotional Molotov cocktails, I grew up with their children. And I am pretty good at politics, so I can manipulate and play people off each other. So I joined with that idea in mind. And the woman running it said, that's great. We're not going to do any of that. We're just going to listen. And we're not going to listen to try and figure out how we convince or control. We're going to listen to understand. And we're going to see what we do from that. And it was transformative. One of the issues that they want that we thought was just batshit crazy, when we listened to why they wanted it, we heard there was real wisdom behind it, and wisdom that we had agreed with. So we were able to accept this thing that was at the start an anathema. And in doing so, we created this sense of listening and understanding and collaboration that was unlike anything I had ever seen. And when it was all said and done, I remember this man, John, reading our articles of separation. And he was practically in tears. And he's like, I love this document. Now, this is one of the guys who was, you know, dead opposed to it just not long before. And this transformation that we all had. And I walked out of that meeting thinking, my God, yeah, if we accomplish that, surely we can change the world. I realized as a leader, it wasn't my job to have the answers. It wasn't my job to point the right direction. It was my employees knew so much more than I thought, and they saw things that I could never possibly see. And over the years, just really recognizing that dynamic and being able to walk into a room to discuss a problem that was intractable and messy and that I had no idea to solve, how to solve, and not have to worry about it. Just know that all I had to do was create the container, you know, of trust and introspection, and the answer would come, you know, and I just had to make sure people recognized it and were listening. And that was a very different version of leadership, one which was much, much better. And I saw the incredible fruits of that. And it was really remarkable. And over the years, I started to see connection to which I was really attached to hierarchy. It's not an easy thing to give up. I mean, we created hierarchies to make sure that illiterate peasants didn't plant the wrong crops and our communities didn't starve, right? We now have all of our employees in most organizations have these devices in our pockets that connect us to the entire compendium of human knowledge. We don't need this structure of telling us people what to do. Yeah, and particularly for organizations that are purpose-driven, who are attracting people who share their purpose and values, those people don't need to be told what to do. They want to do the work. They might need guidance. They might need collaboration. There's all sorts of things that happen. But I mean, if you look at the innovation of a company like Gore, which is non-hierarchical, I mean, my favorite story is, I mean, we're of the same age. I don't know if you broke your arm as a kid, but remember plaster casts, how awful and itchy they were? They were terrible and you couldn't shower. You had to like have your shower. And yeah. And this Gore employee broke his arm and was tired of like trying to find knitting needles to scratch himself. And it was just miserable. And so when he had a cast refit, he brought a piece of Gore-Tex and said, hey, doc, do me a favor. Just put this underneath the plaster. And it was great. It was comfortable. And so Gore created this entire line of cast liners. And it all came from someone saying, oh, I wonder if this would be helpful. Yeah. And so if companies can tap into that creativity, what is possible for them is remarkable. And as we enter this time where, you know, hierarchies just won't work. People at the top of the hierarchy only see about 4 to 6% of the problems that are facing the ground. Employees on the ground, they see all the problems. So organizations that don't make the shift from, you know, command and control to a network system of distributed authority and decision making, I don't believe they'll exist. And the problem is our thinking is so dictated by command and control, most people cannot imagine a different reality.
So a couple of things about that. The hierarchy, I think about how attached we are to that. And I think about a lot of the startups and the companies that are growing and they're getting their first customers and they're hiring their first leaders, right? Like what you described, a non-hierarchical approach sounds a lot like a startup out of necessity, because there's only a handful of people and everybody's doing lots of different things and everyone's got visibility to all the things. But it happens fast. All of a sudden you get $1 million in funding, and now you've got your first VP of sales and your first VP of product. And there you go. There's your hierarchy. All of a sudden, you got three levels in a company that's got 10 people. And I'm wondering, how do people pause? Because once it's built, I think they're screwed. I'm skeptical like you are about how you can take the bigger the company, the harder it is. But the way you can do it is never end up in that situation by pausing and being much more thoughtful about how you build the company from the start.
I think that's the trick is being thoughtful and experimenting. So the two of my favorite companies in the space, Spruitzog, which is a Dutch company, it means something about neighborhood, but it's a home health care agency. It was founded by a nurse and a group of his colleagues who were tired of having every minute of their patient interactive scheduled and dictated from people who had no idea what was going on. They were tired of seeing opportunities to advance patients' health that were outside of that very specific and rigid care prescription that would make a difference in being powerless to do something about it. They were tired of having their intelligence insulted by having, you know, their all their time, you know, monitored and dictated and controlled. And that's not, none of those things were what brought them to nursing. It was really an honest, you know, care for people. So they went out and they started their own thing. And yeah, it was teams of 12 nurses servicing about 60 clients. They, that team of 12 happened, handled everything, you know, and they have now, in about 12 years, 12 to 15 years, they took an 80% market share in, you know, in a highly regulated environment. But they figured it out from the beginning. You're right. They did, but they did experiments. So I think larger organizations, you know, need to do the same for experiments, right? What's going to work for one company isn't going to work for another. Nucor has a hierarchy. Yeah, but they empower all of the decisions in their steel mills to the steel workers, right? The steel workers in the plant decide what products they're making, how to make it, what equipment to use, and how to use that equipment. One of my favorite stories from the book Humanocracy is, they, one plant, Nucor plant, the crucible that they used to melt the scrap metal to create the steel was at the end of its life cycle. It was about 10 years old, and they knew that they could get something more effective. And they went out to market, and they were seeing, you know, cost between $10 and $14 million for a new one. But they didn't like the specs, and they felt it could do more. So they designed their own and had fabricated for about $4 million, huge savings, and implemented. They didn't have to ask permission for that. They didn't, you know, they just did it all on their own. They ended up saving millions of dollars and huge productivity, you know, enhancements on the other side of that. And this wasn't a corporate initiative. You know, they, you know, Nucor had set the container for people to make decisions. They had given them parameters of how they could. They've given them rewards. Nucor employees make, you know, a base salary of about 70% of what is industry average, and the rest is bonus, which they end up making anywhere from 110% to 140% over industry average. Yeah. So, and they're given the autonomy and support to impact their income. And so, I mean, that is a huge win-win. You know, the CEO of Nucor talks about, yeah, I spend no money on R&D, but every one of my employees is constantly researching and development. It's because we don't need to. It's inherent in how it is that we do work. Huge benefits there.
Yeah, interesting. That it's so different than, you know, a traditional big company that has these R&D labs where they come up, they go out and they test and they come up with new things to solve a problem, and it comes back into the traditional hierarchy in the organization and it dies. You know, just it can't survive in that hierarchical environment.
And if you look at the metrics behind corporations, they're just abysmal. 70% of large-scale transformations end in failure. 70%. Yeah. So, I mean, in 2025, it is expected that the U.S. will, U.S. companies will spend $1 trillion on digital transformation. And 70% of that, $700 billion, is going to be wasted as a result of that. Yeah. And this is where this transition, yeah, organizations will figure out how to claw back more of that effectiveness and productivity. Yeah. We have 78% of workers are disengaged, most of them doing the absolute bare minimum, the waste that's involved in that. You know, companies that can figure out how to activate more of that engagement, they're going to be clear winners. Yeah. You know, companies like Birdsog or Morningstar, you know what they don't spend money on? Middle management. Right there alone, 30% of their payroll just doesn't exist. Yeah, they're a tomato processor. This is not a highly profitable business. Their competitors, you know, 2-3% profit margins. They're consistently in double digits. It's not because they're charging more, not because they're paying less. There's something happening in between those two, and it's remarkable. And so, and that's really where I see that transition is coming globally. Is that, I mean, if you look at, it started with millennials. I remember, my clients complaining about millennials who were just saying, like, look, just because you went through hell, why should I have to? Like, I can add value right now. I don't want to wait 10 years to add value. Let's do some stuff right now. You know, and that is getting stronger and stronger. as the generations come forward. And I think the path we're on is just not sustainable. And what's more, as a species, we're facing intractable problems. I mean, the environment, poverty, I mean, there's so many things. We will not solve these things without collaboration. And the environment's particularly pernicious because the solutions to the climate crisis exist right now. We don't need any new technology. Yeah, we just need the political and social will to implement it, period. And that's going to take collaboration. So from my perspective, if we can have collaboration be an integral part of how we work, how we earn our daily bread, well, that experience will change us. We will bring that spirit of collaboration to our families, to our neighborhoods, to our institutions, to our politics. And that's the shift that I see that is possible. That's so exciting.
Wow. I love that. And I could just hear as you're saying that, there's so much of that I can take away and reflect on with the work that I do. You know, this idea of I'm being asked to do more with less, like you're never going to get there. What you mean doing more with less just means burning people out, because you're not, it just means doing more shit with fewer people or less experienced people. And unless you find a smarter way to work, there's only one way that story ends.
Yeah. And I think the other conversation is we have this, we all need to do more, and work-life balance is important. Yeah. And it's this fight between this two. And I don't think it needs to be that way. You know, I mean, I think if we look at the amount of waste and also, I mean, like coming from a guy who was in the staffing industry for years after it was relevant to me, I mean, it is almost impossible to be good at a job that you hate. Yeah. Like that is, you know, it's just so, and it took me way too long to come to that conclusion. But fortunately I was able to do it, and with the help of a pandemic, And so there's so much to activate that. I mean, I think the key to life, work-life balance is as much as setting boundaries as it is doing work that actually feeds you. And, you know, and people, oh, well, you know, we can't do that. We're in accounting or we're a law firm. I mean, I don't know if, you know, there's the movie about, or there was a video about Pike's Place Market in Seattle, the fish place. Yeah. I mean, these are men who are throwing, they're selling dead, slimy animals, for a living. They're throwing them around. They're having the time of their life.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah, if my life was throwing around slimy dead animals, I would be miserable. But they found a way to make it fun. And if they can do it, you're going to tell me a friggin' accountant can't? BS.
I love that. I love that. So, Peter, I've taken up more of your time than I asked for. It's been
This is so much fun.
I know. This is so great.
Yeah.
But I can't leave without asking you what's next. Because I know you're undergoing a bit of a transition here, and I find it just so incredibly inspiring that I've just got to ask you about that before we go.
Well, I just finished, writing or just handed in the second draft of my speech, where I'm really talking about how we, as a species, in order to survive this and thrive during this age of disruption and rapid change, organizations must shift away from command and control to a network system of distributed authority. And so really, my focus is exclusively on perfecting that speech and then developing the engine to get it out there in the world. And what's next after that is perhaps a consulting practice to help organizations with that journey. That might open up out of that speech, and perhaps a book, and see there. But that area of how to facilitate collaboration and connection at work is really is where I intend to spend the rest of my life. And my only regret is I didn't jump onto this journey 8 years ago. But I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah, that's usually a good indicator. Whenever I come across something, I look back and go, shit, I wish I had done this earlier. That's usually a pretty good indicator that I've made the right choice. So didn't you also sell your house?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a daughter who has a very expensive education habit, and the last couple of years have not been very fruitful from an income standpoint. And we realized that the goals we had set for living, we bought a building in Brooklyn 20 years ago, and the goals we had set for this house were no longer valid. I was dreaming of a country home only because I desperately want to live in the woods. And I kind of forgot that I don't need to live in the city anymore. Yeah. And so it just, you know, and my wife had been wanting to leave, and I realized I'm not enjoying this. And then, you know, and then we was, wait a second, this solves so many problems for us. So we don't know where we're going, but we are, 21 days from today, we'll close on our house. And, I had to rapidly clear my background out of all the packing stuff, before our call, we're going to put all our stuff in storage, and we're going to look around. We have some criteria that we're looking for. So we're going to be looking at towns outside of Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Boston, and Denver. And so we're renting Airbnbs. Yeah, we're really not looking any more than 4 weeks out. We're just going to explore, see what we like. And yeah, and then after we visit those four places, we'll figure out what we like the best and spend some time and maybe build a home.
Yeah, I love that. It's kind of going back to your, just start small and test. Like, what's the first thing we have to do? Well, let's sell the house. Whoa, shit, we can't do that. We don't know what's happening. No, let's just... we'll sell the house. And then what are we going to do? I don't know. The next piece out. That's what I love about that story. I think I'm going to see you on TikTok throwing slimy in a market maybe somewhere. I mean, who knows?
I know for a fact that I cannot personally be on TikTok. I have way too much of an addictive personality. I don't think I would ever see the light of day again. So,
yeah. Well, Peter, we talked. Oh, one last thing. So we talked about storytelling. We're going to put some resources because we've touched on some really amazing things. I'd love to get better at storytelling. What advice do you have for people, or where can you point me to, and where can we point our listeners, I guess, to where they can start just doing this better?
So if you want to take a class, my friend Adam Wade, who is on LinkedIn, he is just a masterful storyteller and a masterful teacher. He's great. I'm sure he's doing some online stuff. A long time ago did in-person stuff with him. But the best thing, themoth.org, they have these things called story slams. And it is an open mic. It's an open mic where you got to bring your A game, but you put your name in the hat and they pick 10 storytellers and you go up. The best way to learn how to tell stories is tell stories. That is really and the great thing about the story slams is they're judged, and the judging is not that serious. They just pull people randomly out of the audience to make judging teams. It's not a perfect indicator, but for me, it was great to be able to tell a story and see, okay, my score was average of among the three judges of 8.9, but that woman over there, she told a 9.3 story. What did she do that was different? And that was really the majority of what, when I took Adam's class, what I learned was that I didn't need more stuff, technique. I needed to go deeper into my own experience, which was great. And it's just really telling it, and it's stories, and that's really where I learn the most is see, oh wow, he used this format, and he kept kind of sprinkling these breadcrumbs to his crescendo. Wow, I should try that. And it's watching and just doing it. And I would say finally is the permission to suck at it. It's just very important.
Yes.
Because in the beginning you will, and that's okay. And it doesn't mean you'll tell a bad story.
Well, I love that, Peter. Thank you for sharing so many amazing stories with us today. You've given me a ton to think about, some great resources to chase down. This has really checked a few boxes, the sense of purpose, the storytelling. We talked a bit about empathy, kind of transitioning from one thing to another. Man, these are all things that are front and center to me personally, and the conversations that I'm having over and over with people. So this just came at a perfect time.
And another resource that I just remembered, Chip Conley, who is a business author and a brilliant entrepreneur, has created an organization called the Modern Elder Academy, and they have he gives great resources, but it's really all about transitions at the stage of life, midlife, which he declares at, I believe 60 is the number that he gives. And he really looking at the middle of your adult life, assuming you're going to live to 90, I would be so lucky. But that works for me. I like saying that I am pre-midlife, at 53. So, but Chip Conley is a great person to follow for people who are really looking to make that challenge. He really literally wrote the book on the subject, and he's a beautiful human being.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Peter. This has been just a ton of fun. You've delivered on everything I was expecting, knowing that what a great storyteller you are. This has been a blast.
Oh, thank you. It's so great to connect with you. I was just really touched by our initial meeting at Heroic Folk Speaking. And I'm glad we're getting to talk now.
Yeah, me too. Thanks again, Peter.
The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.